Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation episode 309, recorded Monday, July 31st, for Monday, August 7th, 2017. Scott Johnson. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million people. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hello, and welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk with some of the awesomest people on the internet, in technology, doing all sorts of crazy cool things online and beyond. I'm Jason Howell, by the way. I'm always happy to sit in the chair for Triangulation because I get to talk to some of my favorite people. And that is totally true today. Scott Johnson is joining us today. Frog Pants Network, Extra Life webcomic, podcaster extraordinaire. Can I call you an extraordinaire of podcasting?
Sure. I don't even know what the definition of an extraordinary is anymore. I'm happy to wear the title. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, I mean, extraordinary is in there, and I would qualify you as being very extraordinary, Scott Johnson.
Thank you. I put the air in extraordinary. So
that's right. How you doing, man? It's always great to get the chance to talk to you, and it doesn't happen quite often enough. So that's why I wanted to bring you on. Talk about your skills, your abilities. You are a master of many crafts, not just podcasting, obviously, but you're also an artiste, and we will talk about that. I've also happened to have, I don't know how rare this is, the My Extra Life definitive collection, but I've got it, all of your comics in a single book. I'm very happy to have that.
I only have one or two extra copies left, so technically it is sort of rare. What you could fetch for it, probably not much, but... I'm always happy to see one of those out in the wild. So thank you for that.
There is no eBay for Scott Johnson materials?
Not yet. Well, there was a time, this is years ago, but I made a fun little side business out of buying unused toilet seats, brand new toilet seats at like Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever. And I would take it home and I would set up a camera and I would film myself just doodling all over it with a Sharpie, just black ink. And by the time I'd be done, it'd be full of either a bunch of different drawings or a certain theme. I had a lot of video game themed ones and that sort of thing. And then I would eBay these things for whatever I could get for them and then give that money to charities. I haven't done this in a very long time. But now that you've mentioned something like that, maybe it's time to get back on that wagon because that was a whole lot of fun. And I'm still not entirely sure why anybody wanted a toilet seat that I drew on, but it worked for a while.
Wow. How many of the, I've never even heard of this. How many of those ended up out in the wild bathrooms of the world?
Probably maybe five, maybe four. Wasn't that many. They took forever to do. There's YouTube footage of me doing them in high speed, seeing me draw on them. And the people I've talked to, generally speaking, who've gotten them have hung them up somewhere, not used them for an actual toilet seat. So that's something, I suppose.
Okay. All right. I suddenly made that look that I suddenly gave was my realization that you were talking about the toilet seat and not an entire toilet. I really almost went there. And I was like, okay, the second obvious question is how do you ship a toilet via eBay? But
This is a really good point. And by the way, now you've given me a new idea. Full toilet. Yeah.
You started easy. It's time to ramp this up to the next level. Well, that's awesome. Well, that's one of the things that I love about your work, Scott, is that you're always thinking about new ways to take your art and your passion and package it up because you have the audience, you have people on the other end that are willing to play that game with you and get your art in a bunch of different ways. I mean, I haven't really thought about getting art on a toilet seat before now, let alone a toilet. But I think we've started something.
It was an odd stage for me. But you bring up a decent point that I don't get to talk to people very much about, and that is... And this was unplanned. It was unexpected. But my two love affairs as a kid were talk radio and drawing. That's all I cared about. Those were the two main motivators in my life. And I thought that was just kid stuff, and I'd never get to really use that in my real life as I got older. And I went to school and got a job. It didn't seem like that was going to be an option. And as it turns out, I'm getting to do exactly those things. But moreover, and to your point, what's surprising after all this time is how much one feeds the other.
Absolutely.
In other words, successful shows, and it really is about 50-50 for me, but successful shows tend to lead to people finding out about my artwork, buying prints, spending time in my print store, working with me on commissions. I get approached by people who need books illustrated, and they found out because they listened to a show or whatever. And on the other hand, the art has always been this great way for me to do my own album art, even simple things like that, web stuff, whatever it may be. I kind of have both ends of this, these two unique pieces of production covered. And not only is it make it convenient that I get to do it, but I end up with a more cohesive sort of workflow because I'm kind of doing both ends of it. One sort of feeds the other. And by the end of it all, after all these years of doing this, it suddenly hits me. Yeah, it's like 50-50. 50% of my work and revenue is illustration and comics and that sort of thing. And the other half is all podcasts. And it's not necessarily two things you would automatically think of as synergistic points, but they turned out to be. And that's been one of the nicest surprises and something I didn't plan on or expect.
That's awesome, because you obviously from a young age had a passion in both of these areas. And I think a lot of people live their entire lives not realizing their passions as their actual, you hit a point where you could convert that into being your full-time job. And you are your own boss, and you get to let your passion drive how you earn a living for you and for your family. And a lot of people don't get that. When you were a kid, growing up and being exposed to talk radio and art and all this kind of stuff, how would your parents would have described you at that time period? Like, where did that passion come from? And what would they say about a little Scott Johnson running around in that regard?
Oh, man. I think I was probably a bit of a challenge for my parents, especially my mom. I had a tendency to sort of draw on everything. If I had a job to do,
like toilet seats.
like toilet seats. Very good example. If they had a job to do, like, say, wash the dishes, my siblings would take 15 minutes, be done, and move on with their day. I would tend to get started, and by the time we're an hour into it, no dishes are done, but instead I'm building some sort of soap sculpture out of bubbles, or I'm seeing things in the bubbles that I'm interested in drawing, and I've forgotten all about dishes, and now I'm drawing on a pad somewhere. Like, I had a really hard time focusing on mundane sort of workaday tasks and not having them evolve into fantasy worlds and stories I would tell myself and images and that sort of thing. So I think for a while they thought there was something wrong with me. Like, straight up, in the 80s, they were taking me in to see psychologists saying, well, what's the deal? He can't focus. His grades are kind of bad. He draws all over his homework. Like, those were the kind of common refrains. And I remember at some point I overheard a conversation with my mother and my father. And my mother was clearly the one that was more worried about what this meant for my future. And my dad was kind of on the side of, maybe this is what he's supposed to do. Maybe this is where he'll end up. So why don't we encourage it? Let's try that. And I remember very distinctly from that point on, I was probably 8 or 9. From that point on, feeling nothing but support and help from my parents in this regard. And they encouraged me constantly encouraging me to try new things, to do new stuff. They still tried to push me to be better, academically speaking, and whatever other responsibilities I had that weren't fun and creative. They wanted me to try to buckle down on that stuff. But for the most part, I think I kind of owe them a huge debt of gratitude, because they could have really clamped down and went, nope, we're pushing them through this very narrow definition of what we think somebody growing up in the world today should be, and that's just going to be how it is. And they opted not to do that. And I had a lot of friends whose parents did do that, and there are lots of regrets about what they could have done or should have done or would rather do. They're stuck in jobs they don't love, or in some cases they just lost the skills they had when they were a kid because they never, went on to push any further with those. So yeah, for the most part, I was kind of a goofy, weird kid, and I guess I'm just glad my parents decided to take a chance, because I'm guessing at the time it seemed a little nuts to take that chance.
Yeah. I mean, obviously parents do so much to affect how their child, you know, lives and understands the world and everything like that. And it could go two very different directions. And I feel like I've seen both in the people that I've met, you know, between those children whose parents realized from a very young age that they had a very specific interest and fostered that, and those who were afraid of it because they didn't understand it or because it didn't fit those norms. And then that leads to, you know, completely different troubles when they grow up. And one thing that's around this, as a parent of the modern age, maybe it was this way, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't, I wouldn't say that my kids were my parents were necessarily driving me around to soccer practice and basketball camp and blah, blah, blah. Now I feel like parents are very busy keeping their children busy, and hopefully that ties into their passion. Were your parents, I mean, was there ever a point where they established kind of a foundation for you to model your art around once they realized you were super creative at that point?
It was not so much as I think they just saw that I wasn't going to be the soccer kid. I tried. Right. I was bad at it. I hated it. So I quit playing soccer. Tried baseball, tried basketball. Outside of playing with my friends, I didn't enjoy it. So none of that competitive level, he's going to play, you know, basketball in high school stuff worked on me, even though, like you, I'm a pretty tall guy, 6'4", totally could have played basketball if I really wanted to. It just wasn't my gig. And so I tend to hang out with the kids who were playing D&D on the weekends, and they're all playing, you know, Nintendo games and just kind of screwing around, and didn't have a lot of friends outside of my sort of geek and nerd crowd. And I think they saw that that was a good, healthy place for me to be. They saw that I was not only making friends there, but I had kind of a leadership role in these groups. And we were not up to no good. We were, generally speaking, interested in stuff that was dealing with science or dealing with, you know, fantasy or science fiction or just fun, for lack of a better term, wholesome stuff for a bunch of, you know, junior high and high school kids to be into. And I think that gave them a lot of... you know, that may help them relax a little bit, because we weren't, you know, digging up dead cats and setting them on fire and putting them in moving cars or anything weird like that. Like we were, I don't know why that's so specific.
But you know what? We all know what you're talking about.
Yeah, like, you know what I mean.
We identify.
Kids are up to stuff, and that didn't so much interest me. But it's funny because that being allowed to sort of thrive in those peer groups has definitely evolved into what I do today. I mean, my shows, the entire network, my comics, all the content I create, almost 100% of it surrounds sort of the nerdier pursuits of life, whether it be video games or film or television or technology or whatever it may be. That's the bulk of what I do now. So I think that that led to that. Like it at least let me know that I was running in the right circles. Little did I know, as most of us would not have known at that time of our lives, that one day we would be kind of the ruling class culturally. Like if you'd have told me in the 80s, hey, you know, you're really into Spider-Man and Captain America and all that stuff. What if those were the biggest grossing films of the 20-teens? I would have laughed in your face. I would have said, not only that would I have laughed, but I would have said, hey, Marvel's about to sell themselves off because they can't make it work. Like all of that stuff was so looked down upon, frowned upon, not developed for anything other than your average young kid. And to see it be the sort of standard mainstream entertainment today tells you everything you need to know about that generation coming of age. Mm-hmm. I think, lucky to be in that generation, but more lucky to have entered adulthood right around the time the internet happened in a way that we could all use it, and have been able to stick with that all the way through today and found, you know, the different doors that it opened for me. If I wanted to be a comic artist 20 years ago, I would have to rely on this old archaic system of go to a syndicate and say, all right, well, here's my stuff, and I submit it. And they turn it down 5 or 6 or 7 times, and maybe you get in, but only because you have a friend that works at Universal. So, okay, great, now I'm in, but that doesn't really guarantee anything. And I've sold all my rights off, and there are 50 editors between me and every paper. Like all of those things wiped clean and gone now. Sadly, to the detriment of daily comics in newspapers, because that's kind of a dying art now. But it opened up this brand new place where me and a reader can get this close to each other, and I can give them exactly what I want to give them. They can get exactly out of it what they want to. And today, with things like Patreon and a million other methods and ways, they can give back directly. That is crazy. And the fact that I've been able to sort of ride that wave from its inception has been this huge benefit for me. And I cannot imagine what it must have been like for somebody with these same kinds of ideas and pursuits. They just would have been ignored or looked over. They just didn't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And now everybody, be they mediocre to excellent, has a way to do it, and they can all make their way with it. And it's pretty insane. It's good for me. It's good for me to do shows like this, because I don't think I appreciate that as much on the day-to-day as I should. And definitely thinking about it more today.
Well, we're going to get into, Scott, into kind of at a deeper level, what that meant, what that transition meant when you were, you know, kind of moving things into the online realm, taking your art, going there, then, of course, the podcast studio and everything, right after we take this quick break. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by FreshBooks. They have an all-new version of their cloud accounting software that you're going to want to check out. It's going to make running your business easy, fast, and secure. The FreshBooks dashboard actually gives you quick access to your spending, outstanding balances, total profit, and accounting reports like sales tax summary and profit loss. Time tracking features obviously make it really easy to bill for time by client and by specific projects. You just press play to track your time down to the minute. When it comes time to create an invoice, you'll know what you did and when you did it. It's very informative after the fact. You can now assign services to projects and designate different rates for each service so you can bill more accurately for your time. You can also send professional-looking invoices online and get paid an average of 11 days faster. And with FreshBooks Payments, your customer can pay straight from their invoice. Make it super easy for them to pay you. See what invoices have been sent, viewed, and then, of course, see which ones have been paid. And you can brand and set recurring invoices. You can set automatic payment reminders or set automatic late fees. You can automate a lot of what's happening with invoices. Stay connected to your clients and keep tabs on your business no matter where you are with the FreshBooks app. You can do things like snap a photo of your receipt, or you can connect your bank account or credit card to automatically import your expenses daily to take a little bit of that heavy lifting off of you. FreshBooks integrates with Stripe, Shopify, Gusto, Acuity Scheduling, and more. FreshBooks is adding new features and improvements to their platform all the time on a weekly basis. So you can now do things like reward prompt clients and encourage customer loyalty by adding discounts to recurring templates. You can open an invoice in a new browser tab window so you can work across several invoices simultaneously. Adding features all the time. It's no wonder they were included in the Forbes Small Giants list for 2017. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. You'll want to enter triangulation in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/triangulation. Enter triangulation in How Did You Hear About Us. And we thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode of Triangulation. So, okay, so you've made this transition from, you know, being a kid with a growing interest in art and learning how to do this, and then suddenly you're a little bit older, the internet comes along, it enables, you know, everybody's kind of learning as they go along, but what I think the internet coming into the form in the way that it did actually did in retrospect is it democratized so much of this stuff. And you, mm-hmm. I mean, how long did it take for you to get to the point where you were like, let me take my art, let me put it online, we'll do Extra Life webcomics? I mean, maybe that was just the second part of this transition. When did that all begin?
Well, so right out of high school, I went to college and studied art, mostly very traditional stuff, because again, at the time, there were no specialties into digital art. Digital art didn't exist really at that point,
right?
Not in the form it does today. It was for the very privileged few, that sort of thing. You might be able to take back then like a PageMaker class. Of course, PageMaker doesn't even exist anymore, but you know, you had the sort of the Adobe stuff happening and you were, you know, working on Macs and that sort of thing. But that was about the extent of that side. It was mostly focused on desktop publishing. And so when I got in there, there was a lot of life drawing classes and, you know, studying art history and that sort of thing, working toward that kind of stuff, working toward being a commercial artist / graphic designer. But I didn't know where I would end up. Jump forward to like 93, 94-ish, And, you know, Usenet's a huge thing, and I'm playing Doom because I downloaded it off the internet, which was still relatively unknown to people who hadn't quite seen what the web would become. So along comes the World Wide Web a year later. And then in my mind, everything changed, or at least started to change. I started to see what the internet could be, and that could be a whole lot of things. It was still kind of hard to get in those early days, though, because registering a website was still expensive. It was tricky. Nobody really knew how to do it. And then hosting somewhere, there weren't a million hosts to get to host your website. You had all very limited options in those early days. So I tinkered a lot, messed around a lot. A lot of video game stuff happened around then. 96, Quake came out, and we couldn't get enough of Quake, and we were playing it over dial-up connections, and it was the most amazing thing ever. But I still was working for a company, was doing graphic design for them, kind of biding my time, all the while creating art and doing other things their traditional way, submitting them to magazines, trying to get into Psychology Today or whatever with some single panel comic. And they'd send these nice letters back and tell me, you know, how warmly appreciated it was that I would submit, but sorry, we're not, you know, can't use it at this time sort of thing. That was just kind of my mode. And suddenly in the mid to late 90s, things like hosting become possible. A little weird format called MP3 happened.
Yeah, I remember that one.
That really changed my life. And at the time, in 1998, I started what may be, I don't know if it's the first podcast ever. I don't take any credit for this because I don't know. Because it wasn't a podcast, that's for sure. But it was right. A 56K downloadable MP3 file that I created weekly for a video game I was really into. And I created basically a fan show for it. And I had call-ins, and I had, you know, all this kind of stuff, very radio-like stuff. Oh, and by the way, at this time, I'm also volunteering every weekend at a local AM radio station, talk radio station, just to come in and do computer tech calls during this computer segment they had. They didn't pay for it. It wasn't a paid gig or anything, but I just loved it so much, and I'd go in there, and I'd just volunteer and do it. So I was already had that kind of bug going on. I start this little show. We put it up on a web page. People can download it.
What was the name of the show?
It was called Infiltration Radio, and it's the game was called Infiltration. It was actually a mod for Unreal Tournament back then, and I was super, super into it. The game was really neat. Did a lot of things that modern games have borrowed from since, whether they know it or not. But anyway, I was so into it that I was producing this content and then also started a webcomic. And that webcomic was called, I think I called it Real Tunes. It was stupid, but it was basically like jokes about military-style shooter games. And I started putting that up in various places, and that ended up getting picked up by, at the time, GameSpy.com, which was still sort of running big then. And that started an interesting relationship. And then the show, you know, continued to grow and do all these things. But again, there was no podcasting. There was no RSS. It was basically Winamp players. People would download and play it on that thing. And it would take forever to get a 5-meg file because, again, we're back in the Napster days here.
Yep.
And but that really was the start. That's when things were like, whoa, okay, this is... These are two things I can not only do, but I'm getting like reactions out of people. I'm getting emails flooding in. I have questions. People want to be interviewed. I have stuff happening, and I didn't, you know, there's no money being made, but there was definitely this weird interest. And that's where it dawned on me. This could be a thing. I didn't know how quickly or what its final form would be. I'm still not sure, by the way, of all these questions, because I don't think we're anywhere near final form on this stuff. But I knew there was something there. Jump ahead a bunch of years. I started Extra Life Radio right around the time I started the comic. That comic started in 2001. Extra Life Radio a year later. That was just a way to talk to my fans that read the comic.
And you were were you presenting this art and this Extra Life Radio to the same audience, like through the same portal? Because I mean, you could put up a site, but you gotta make sure that the people actually find it. You know, that was a big challenge then.
Yeah, and you're also talking pre Facebook, pre Twitter, right. Everything, right? So there was no way to sort of virally, well, it's truly, you could still be discovered virally, but it had to be truly virally, not just because someone ran into your Twitter post. So it was a lot of very grassroots stuff. Like, all right, I've got a website. I have an audience who's been following me a little bit, but how do I expand? So it was a lot of posts in forums, or it was going to the web comics portals that existed then. They were kind of like web rings. They don't exist so much anymore. They kind of do.
The web rings, yeah.
Those were big. And so I would submit my comic to those, and they would bring in some people. And it was just kind of this slow and steady wins the race, which is important because I actually think that that's my entire key, has been this slow and steady incline. There's no such thing in what I've done with Frog Pants, with the artwork, with anything that was like one of these jumps. It was always this slow ramp up. never any dips, but always this ramp up. And I think that's a good stable way to expect things to go if you're making quote unquote new media these days. I hate that term now, but kind of new old media, whatever we're going to call it. Media. But that audience has been really faithful. It's followed me all through that time. It's really when 2004 hit, the comics are doing well already. They've been up for 4 years. They're starting to sell, you know, prints, and I'm getting commissions. And so that's actually starting to sustain itself. Still working a, you know, full-time job, but this stuff's starting to pick up at home. But when 04 hits and the RSS standard happens and podcasting as a thing ignites, all bets are off. I saw that for what it was and went, this is it. This is where we're going. And I just kind of threw everything into it. Didn't know how long it would take. Took me a little longer because I was chicken. I wish I would have jumped out earlier, sooner. But you were actually there the day I did it.
Yep.
I called into the 1,000th episode of Buzz Out Loud and made my announcement that I was leaving and doing it full time in 2008. And it's been great ever since. Again, my only regret is I didn't do it sooner. I think I could have accomplished more. But now I've only got me as a boss, and I'm kind of a jerk to myself. I don't let myself take a lot of time off. I'm real bad about vacations and things, but it is literally me doing what my 8-year-old self wanted to do. And I wish I could go back in time, not scare him off, because he'd have had a little stranger danger moment there probably. But I just want to tell him face to face, dude, trust me, I'm a little fatter. I got a little gray going, but it's awesome here where I'm at. So just keep at it. Be excited. All the things you think are cool are about to become cool for everyone. And if I could do that, it would just make that kid a lot happier than he was at 8 or 9.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a crazy roller coaster since, and very hard for me to say what the key to it has been, other than community is everything. Outreach to your fans is everything. Making real life connections with them. They'll be loyal. They'll stick with you. They'll tell their friends. That will grow on its own. And again, that slow and steady wins the race sort of approach is a really viable one. Everybody wants to do it overnight, but I just think that is the one that is the most rare of cases. It can happen, but and when it does, it usually means you can fall just as quickly.
Absolutely.
I really like this slow way of going.
Yeah, you're able to put the pieces in place and understand how to navigate through it. If it's slower, if it happens suddenly, you know, you a lot of times people just aren't ready to deal with that. But that's what people see when they go to YouTube. They see these, you know, millions of views, and when you start to do the numbers on that, you start to think, oh, well, anybody could do this. It's going to be really easy for me to come in here and make this sort of money and, you know, all this stuff. But it really doesn't work like that for the majority of people. You mentioned community. And I mean, community is something that, you know, like you say, I completely agree with, is vital to what we do in this industry right now. Community back then was a very different thing. I mean, it existed. You were also talking about Usenet. I remember Usenet, you know, being a great place to go to find like-minded individuals, be it very narrow passions or even wider or whatever. What was it like to create a community around a show at that early age? Because, I mean, not only was podcast not really a thing, but, I mean, you were doing a lot of things very new here and creating a community around it. That couldn't have been easy.
No, I mean, it wasn't. But also I didn't know it wasn't, because I didn't really know what was happening. Like, it kind of was happening without me trying. It was really valuable data, though, in those early days to kind of learn what it meant to connect with people and then not necessarily have them dictate your content. I say that anybody who wants to make something, they should make what they have the most passion to make, even if somebody's anywhere has some disagreement with it. I think the healthy thing is for you to make what you're going to make. But it still has an effect. If you know, like our old friend Tom Merritt once said, you get the chat room you deserve. And I've always held kind of tightly to that idea of, the kind of work you put out will come back to you and the kind of people that follow you or appreciate what you do. Mm-hmm. And that became pretty apparent early on. And it was, you know, to get back to what it was like then versus now. I mean, Usenet, what is Usenet if not Reddit of 30 years ago?
Totally.
What is, you know, Facebook if not forums of 10 years ago? At the time that this was all hitting for me, it was mostly forums, and forums were just starting to take off as a huge thing. You'd start to see websites that were just forums. That's all they did, was cater to a certain community. And this was especially true in PC gaming circles, which I was a big part of. So that was the place where the seeds were planted. The first beginnings of this community started to sort of come from, the conversations would happen, the kind of feedback you want to get would happen. And there just became kind of a feedback loop of positivity there, where I'd do a thing, people would like that thing, that would motivate me to want to do another thing. And I would kind of know what was working, what wasn't, learning about things like sometimes your dumbest idea is the one that hits the hardest. Sometimes the one you think you worked the hardest on is not hitting at all. Like those kinds of lessons happened early with that early community. And I'm really grateful for that. But I've just sort of tried to evolve with it. The advantage I have now, and let's go back to 2011 when I launched the morning show that I host now with Brian Ibbett. That one right now, if you add up all the days I do it, is the biggest thing we're doing. And it has the most attention. It gets the most sponsors. It's got the most listenership. It has the most live watchers. Like all that stuff has just grown very quickly from 2011 till now, which I guess hasn't been that. Well, it has been. That's 6 years ago, mm-hmm. 7 years.
Wow, almost. I can't believe it's been that long.
Awesome. I know. It's nuts. But when I started that thing, it was purely, I like morning shows, but I hate kind of the Bob and Tom honking the horn, you know, let's play pranks on people show. I hate that stuff. Everyone laughs at their own jokes for 20 minutes. I can't stand it. So I wanted to do something different. And it was purely a passion play for me. Nothing else. I thought, I'm doing this for me. And if it doesn't go anywhere, fine. I don't care. I'm excited about it. And that ended up being, you know, a big deal for me. Totally hit. Continues to hit. Is one of our best things we have going. And sometimes it's those instincts that you just have to trust, especially if you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
But building back to the point of community, building community around the morning show was easier for me because I had just spent the last 5 years building community around Extra Life Radio, around The Instance, around AppSlappy, around these other shows like FilmSack. We had you know, grown other shows during that time that were benefiting from the Extra Life Radio transfer of people. And that had grown larger. The Instance got much bigger because of World of Warcraft's popularity, and our focus on it apparently was a thing people wanted then. And so that created a bunch of new growth. So by the time I started the morning show, we had this built-in group who was just ready for a new thing we were going to do. And it was, you know, it wasn't like we had to start from scratch, from square one, and get 3 downloads and hope it grew from there. We could get a ton of downloads on our first episode and only build from there. And that was a huge, you know, that's a huge benefit. But that stuff only comes after paying your dues with the other stuff early on. So to say I have a perfect formula for this, I think I have one, but mine takes forever. The it's a slow, you know, 10-year process of consistency, of quality, of passionate work, and you'll have your community. If you're trying to get one overnight, very hard. And those who do, that community usually turns on them just as quickly as they turned with them. And it's like winning the lottery. How many times you ever hear about people winning the lottery who then go on to have 4 generations of stable financial stability? It doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't.
What happens is they get that and they crash and burn. They learn their lesson and perhaps they move on. But I don't ever want that crash and burn. So as much as it's hard for me sometimes to see somebody go viral with an idea I had 4 years earlier and just couldn't execute on, I always have to remind myself, well, all right, but you probably would rather have it be the long, slow trip than the short, brief, you know, flash in the sun, because it just goes away as quickly as it comes. So anyway, people can take that for whatever it's worth. It's not the greatest advice, but building community over time means that these relationships are cemented. It means that these people are there for the long haul. When we've had some pass away, it's not just, oh, I heard somebody who was on our forums die. That's sad. Anyway, it's more like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe this person died. Let's rally around their family and send them things. Let's have a bunch of us road trip to the funeral. Let's establish something in the community in this person's name and try to carry on their legacy. Like, that's the kind of community we have now. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing, like with family or anybody else, just takes time. You know, you can't force it. You have to build it, and building it takes time.
I completely agree with that. How is community different between what you're doing with podcasts? Because Extra Life Radio, this is like still officially when that launched, pre-podcast, but you know, that was 2003. You had your Extra Life webcomics that you were bringing to the site in 2001, so a little bit prior to that. But I mean, these things are happening concurrently. So I imagine a lot of the community is on both sides. How does that community translate into the work that you're doing at that point of your at that stage around your art? Is there a lot of similarity between those people?
Well, there's a lot more crossover than ever, but there's still, in some ways, there's still separate camps. I mean, not that they're opposed in any way, but there will be people who will say, oh, I love your artwork and this and that and the other. I've never heard one of your shows, but I'm sure those are good. It's just not my thing, but I really love your artwork. And then someone else will say the same thing. I didn't even know you drew. When did that start? And I'm like, well, like my whole life it started. So there is a lot of left hands, not exactly always totally sure what the right hand's doing community wise. But I think I'm okay with that. Actually, I think I'm really good with that because I can't expect there to be this homogenous group of exact-minded people like any community. It's not feasible. Mm-hmm. Whether you're talking about a town or a city or a state or a country or anything, it's just you've got a diversity of opinion and background and everything else that come into it that you just – there's no way to control it. So there's no reason to try to control it. It's better to, I think, embrace it. Mm-hmm. So what I always do is just try to – lightly encourage people to check the other side out. So if there's an opportunity on a show to run a contest for some signed artwork, some framed art I did or whatever, I'll run the contest on the show. And that will let those who already are sort of into both get excited. And those who don't know about it, maybe get a first taste of it. Same thing goes on the other side. I can create, you know, album art for other shows and have them go, oh, that's Wayne. Is he the same guy that hosts the morning show? Oh, good, weird. And have all these like strange sort of, you know, comings together that can come out of that. But let them happen on their own. Like I'm a big proponent of not trying to squeeze that stuff through a Play-Doh machine and get the perfect shape out the other side. Yeah. That's a pretty good analogy right there, dude. You can use that sometime if you want it.
I think it's actually pretty perfect. I would completely agree. But Play-Doh also has a lot of annoying things. It gets in the carpet, you know, you track it through the house.
It's a good point.
All right. We're going to talk. I really want to dive into kind of the art, your digital art life, and maybe even get into some of the tools that you use, how that's evolved over the years, that sort of stuff. We'll talk about that here in a moment. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. It's all about, you know, whether you're looking to get a mortgage for a new home or maybe even, you know, refinance your existing mortgage. You can do that all with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, and they make it really easy. And they needed to. The mortgage experience was not keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. It needed a fresh start. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or, like I said, refinancing your existing home loan. It works for both. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all of the details. You can also be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you when you're setting it up. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful, whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, got a portfolio of homes. Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds based on your income, your assets, and credit. Rocket Mortgage will analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify, specifically for you, matched to you, and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. So Extra Life webcomics, that's happening online. At this point, when was the transition between doing art the old-fashioned way and the new way when it comes to digital tools? Because much of what you do right now, especially, and I imagine back then too, I mean, were you drawing your art on a piece of paper and then scanning it? Were you using full-on digital tools like I assume you are right now? What did that look like then?
So when I started the MyExtraLife.com comic in 2001, I had jumped to a hybrid solution, and it's from other work I'd been doing previous to that, that sort of led to this, but basically it was two stages. It was, ink on paper. And, then I would take that, or I'd, you know, pencil and ink on paper. Then I would take that stuff, scan it. I'd pull it into a computer. At the time it was a PC. I would run Photoshop and I would color using Photoshop, using like a Wacom Intuos tablet, nothing with a screen on it, just, you know, a nice flat basic under $50 tablet. I did that for years and years and years. And always on the horizon was the potential of this, you know, Wacom huge 21-inch sort of lifestyle I could live. But it was always way out of my price range, and I just kind of took me forever to get to it. That all changed in, well, it started to change in about 2004. I started drawing directly onto screen, but I would scan in pencil sketches first. Then I would use that same Wacom, and I got really good at like eyeballing the screen and matching it up with what my hand was doing. A skill I wouldn't necessarily recommend for people because it's a huge pain in the butt to get down, but I think it helped me along the way. And by the way, I should mention this. Back then, I thought I was pretty good. I thought my stuff was all right. I think now, in retrospect, I was terrible back then. Now, a lot of people say this about their old artwork. I get it. This isn't anything new. But I really dislike my early stuff, with a few exceptions. But it is fun to see it evolve and see it go from those crummy early days to what I think is pretty good stuff now. So then in about 07, I jumped out, finally ordered. They put out a Wacom that was only 12-inch. And I remember thinking, oh, man, that's a perfect kind of stepping stone. I go to a screen interface. Let's do this. And that changed a lot for me. And basically from then on, it is very rare I have paper anywhere anymore, or a Bristol board or any traditional, you know, pens and that sort of thing. I kind of was the time I jumped off and went full digital, from sketches to inking to finishing to, you know, getting print ready, whatever it is I'm doing. That's kind of where it started for me. And just sort of been upgrading that ever since. I'm up to a 24-inch Wacom tablet that I use right now for production work. But there's a lot of really interesting things happening on a more mobile basis. Recently tested all the drawing tablet / pen combinations that I could get my hands on to see if I could figure out who's doing it the best right now. And given that Twit's such a tech-focused network, I think this might be kind of fun to tell you. So here are my non-scientific results, okay?
All right.
Been using Wacom for years, so I'll get back to them in a second. I tried the new Surface Pro. I would like to say the Surface Pro 2, which is now a couple of generations old, was the best they'd ever done with drawing stuff. They had a Wacom pen. They used the Wacom engine. That was a really tight drawing display. It worked really well. Since then, Microsoft dumped Wacom as their primary provider for that, do their own thing now, and it's laggy as all get out. So it's sufficient for a lot of people, but I really found it to be a laggy mess on the Surface Pro 4, which is depressing to me because I really like that device otherwise. I think it's solid. I've used their Surface Pro or the Surface Studio, the big desktop jobber that lays down and all that, came out earlier this year. Same problem, huge lag. Really cool setup. Love the idea behind it. I love the focus of that device. Drawing lag is bad. The latency on that pen is kind of terrible. And the pressure sensitivity is not great either.
What is bad latency in the world of a digital artist?
Well, I mean, we're probably going to have to measure it in not seconds, but nanoseconds.
Right.
But when you move a pen and you can visibly tell that the line is trying to keep up with you, that's my sign that I want as little of that as possible. And so I just about launched something onto the floor. And so I'm always aiming to reduce that as best I can. And they've gotten better over time. Wacom, however you prefer to say it. I've always said both. They've gotten better over time as well. But I'll tell you right now, the entire run of everybody who's making everything, including some Japanese or some Chinese knockoffs that I tried on eBay and some other things, by far, and this is not being an Apple fanboy, by far the Apple Pencil and iPad Pro combo, the least amount of latency for any of these devices.
Wow.
Like straight up, bar none, nothing's even close. And I don't know what they're doing different or why nobody else can do it yet. It may have something to do with that's a charged device as opposed to a Wacom pen, which is not a charged device.
Right.
It's a technology that uses the display for what it does. So there may be some latency reasons there. But even compared to this 24-inch, top-of-the-line Wacom, with as low a latency as it's capable of doing, the iPad Pro and Pencil just knock it out of the water.
So does that mean that the iPad Pro and Pencil ends up being... Well, I mean, I imagine that means that's your mobile choice. But are there reasons that you wouldn't use that for your kind of like your workhorse?
So it's a really good question. This is the problem with any tablet of any kind. That form factor is awesome for all the things it does right. But it's not full-blown desktop software, right? Like that's one of the advantages of the Surface laptops and tablets, is that you can use Photoshop or you can use Painter or whatever it is you're using.
Right.
You can use it natively the way it was meant to be. So you're using professional grade applications on the device. That lag is just a real bummer. On the iPad's case, you've got lots of apps, some really good ones. And by the way, I'll recommend a couple for people who are thinking, well, I have this, but I don't know what the best apps are. The best app by far, without any question in my mind, for the iPad Pro currently for art of any kind, sketching all the way to finished painting, whatever it may be, is a program called Procreate. It is awesome. It's cheap. It's like $5 and it's amazing. If they made a desktop version of that, we'd all be in heaven. It's a wonderful, wonderful app.
Wow.
But I have a CC account with Adobe, and I use Adobe for almost everything else. I use Premiere, I use Audition, I use Photoshop, I use Illustrator, all of it. And it's a thing I love paying for. It's my favorite subscription that I have for anything. And it's great, except for they've got these apps, Sketch and Draw, on the iPad. They're both okay, but they're just like really watered down basic versions of what the desktop apps will do, Illustrator and Photoshop. It does have some nice features, like I'm done drawing here, I want to send it to my desktop. I hit a single button and all of a sudden my computer fires up and auto loads this thing. And there it is, as if I was sitting there the whole time. There's some neat stuff like that. But the apps themselves just aren't that great, especially compared to Procreate. So this is my long roundabout way of saying we still kind of have that problem where the tablets aren't quite running feature to feature like we are with desktop. Mm-hmm. The day that happens, that changes everything. As it stands right now in Procreate, I can go complete art if I want, or I can use it just to get sketches done and then quickly throw them to Dropbox in PSD format and then reopen them when I'm back here at the studio or something. And that's working out great. There's a lot of, you know, synergy there and it's good. I just really look forward to the day where the best pen and the best tablet are tied to also the best software. And right now that's not exactly happening. But all that being said, if I'd have had this thing back in 2005, oh my gosh, I mean, the whole world would change.
Yeah.
It'd be incredible. And I love where we're at and where we're going with it. And I also like that Apple has seemingly thrown us artists a bone, because in recent years they've kind of moved away from that core area that they were known so well for. They were so synonymous with desktop publishing and artists and everything else and animation and filmmaking and editing. And they got away from that a little bit. So for me, this was a real bone. This was them saying, we're still into that. Because this is clearly made for artists. It's clearly made for those looking for precision and speed. And that's exciting. I hope they can stick with that and continue to improve that product. I think the iMac Pro that was shown at WWDC this year, had a built-in digitizer and pen, it would have been the end-all, be-all computer I'd want this year, like bar none. Without that, I can't justify it.
And it doesn't sound like that's in their plan. At least that's what they're saying. But that's what they would say until suddenly they surprise you with it. Who knows if they're going to go in that direction for professionals in this regard? Because they kind of go back and forth when it comes to the pro market.
They do. I remember Steve Jobs said, we'll never do a stylus with an iPad. And then now they have one.
Yep.
So I think it's a matter of finding the right use case, maybe swallowing your pride a little bit and looking at what your customers really want. You know, Apple's weird this way, but they have, with that particular device and that particular pen input, have really killed it. And it's surprising to me. So it's usually my recommendation if someone's trying to get into something for under $1,000, you can do a whole lot of damage with one of those. It's pretty good.
This is a question that I have often. I have some friends who are big into producing art. They've created art for as long, you know, as I've known them. Yet when it comes to the tricky kind of transition from creating it because you're passionate about it to creating it for, you know, as a business or as a way to live your life, creating for money, you know, let's say, that ends up being, monetizing their passion ends up being a big challenge. Not only that, producing on a schedule, which I think is somewhat required when you move into this professional realm, at least to a certain degree. How did that play out for you in the time of Extra Life, where you were on this regular schedule, where you were putting up art very regularly? I know that probably swiftly improved your capabilities doing it so often. But did you ever have challenges around meeting that schedule, monetizing your passion? Did you ever have any hangups there?
Well, that's a really great question. No one's really ever asked me that before. I mean, the schedule shifted a lot over the years too. There was a time where I was doing 5 comics a week. Then there was a time I was doing 1 a week. Then there was a time I was back to doing 3. Right now I do as many as I can get up there a week. It's a little less stringent now, but the idea of having to put yourself in a creative space on a schedule is almost antithetical to being in a creative space.
Absolutely.
So it's a really interesting point you bring up, and absolutely has an effect. What's funny is sometimes it's when I throw my arms up in the air because I'm writer's blocked or I can't think of anything funny or worth talking about or trying to draw or whatever. And then I just throw something weird down, ends up just solving the problem. It ends up being more shared and more liked and more whatever than something I would have put a bunch of extra thought into. So I do think there's something to the discipline of just sometimes just, you know, blurp it out and hope it sticks. Which sounds reckless, but it kind of is a great way to sort of create, get your creative juices going. I think of it as kind of a blockage in a pipe or something, and you're just blowing that thing out. So you've got a nice smooth attempt the next time. That's kind of starting to sound kind of gross actually, but that's kind of what I'm doing. and it still comes up, you know, I'll have an idea and it just doesn't work, or I get frustrated. And all I'm thinking about is, well, I said I'd have this on Tuesday.
Right.
Instead of what I should be saying is I should have this when it makes the most sense to have it. So it's a balance. It's hard. I go back and forth. Where it gets really tricky is when you're doing somebody else's work. So if you're doing a commission or you're doing a book illustration or a cover or something, and I've had to do all of those before. If you're working with somebody who really trusts your instincts, piece of cake. You come up with a concept. They approve it. You ink it. They approve it. You color it. They approve it. Like all steps of the way, they're like, I want Scott Johnson work. And so I'm glad you're doing that for me. Done. They pay you, you get out of there. But then there is always this off chance, or maybe more often than not, that somebody's got very specific ideas in their own head. They just can't execute it personally. So they're having you do it, and they're maybe pulling you in directions and pushing you in places you don't want to go or you don't know how to go. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's beyond your skill set. Sometimes it's just you hate it. A lot of times for me, that's what it is. I just hate somebody's idea and I can't stand executing their idea because I think it's just such a bad idea. And I've even said to them, this is a bad idea, and they still want their idea. That's when it gets really hard because you've got schedule, you've got deadlines, and you're making a thing you don't love. But I'm a firm believer that those are dues you have to pay. You can't just cherry pick only the things you want to do in anything in life, let alone this business. So there are plenty of days where I'm not inspired to do a morning show. And there are days where I was, but the show went bad. And there were days where I wasn't inspired, but ended up being the best show ever. And there were days when I didn't want to record anything, and I still did it, and it was bad all around. Well, them's the breaks, as far as I'm concerned. You have to do it to obtain those skills, to get better at it. And what usually happens is, if you've done this enough, call it the 10,000 hour rule or whatever you want, but if you've done this enough, you get to a place where someone will hear what you thought was a bad show, or they'll see what you think is crappy art, and they don't see it. They'll see it and go, oh, I love this. What are you talking about? I thought you were great today. What do you mean that you thought the show was a little lousy? You're to a point professionally where you are not letting that leak to people. You're just critiquing your own work. And it, to them, it still looks professional. It still looks good. It's still better than what they expected. So somehow balancing the ability to always remember that, but also be willing to push through, I think is really, really important.
I think that's an even higher level of becoming a professional in a creative world, right? It's like you start off with a passion and creativity and you do it because you love it. At a certain point, you evolve to this point where you're like, well, maybe this could be the thing that I do. And then you have to learn how to work with, you know, things that maybe aren't so fun, like a schedule or a requirement from a client, or just getting over the fact that you're getting paid for something and there's inherent pressure involved there. The next evolution of that is to get beyond that, to be able to remember all aspects, you know, be able to give your creativity to a level that it appeases you, and that you understand that the person on the other end trusts your input, and you can go ahead and accept money for that. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all right. Exactly. Sometimes you just have to let yourself do the things that feel a little uncomfortable. Yeah. And oftentimes even stuff I don't like that I finished today, I'll look at it in a year and go, oh, actually that was pretty good. Yep. Like you'll have a more objective perspective on your own stuff as time passes.
Yep.
Another really interesting aspect of this, that kind of building that work ethic and teaching yourself how to push through these things, for me specifically has had even a greater impact. I have three kids and all three of them seem to be heading to very creative pursuits. My oldest daughter quit her job and is now working as a full-time wedding and infant photographer. And she's turning down clients because she's that popular. This isn't just dad pride moment. This is like straight up, she's killing it. And she's doing it on raw talent and raw motivation. I have another daughter who's getting into animation and illustration and is already seeing that pay off in huge ways. Supposedly her artwork's going to show up in the season premiere of Bob's Burgers somehow.
Are I don't you even serious? Know how. Her art is great, yeah. By the way.
She is really good. She's far surpassed me at her age. Like not even a remnant of closeness. To
she
where
has
she
an excellent mentor. Before. Yeah.
Now that's kind of my key. And Nick seems to be following a lot of the same path. He does a lot with 3D modeling and some other stuff. But living in a household where that creativity is encouraged is one thing, and we do that. But secondly, and not to make this all a parenting tip, because I work at home, I am in this studio, I'm constantly building this content. It's kind of a weird dad job, all right? Hard to explain. I just got back from a family reunion for 2 weeks of family reunions, two different families, and probably explained zero of what I do to people properly. Nobody really gets it. Just don't get it. And that's okay. But these kids, they see me do it every day. They're a part of it in a very real way because they help with some. They, you know, some of the logistics of what we do and stuff they kick in on. I think that's really cool and important. It helped me raise my kids, to be honest, because they saw that you can do something you have a lot of passion and fun for, but you just have to focus and get it done. Like sometimes just getting it done matters. Sometimes doing it for yourself matters. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's easy. They get to see it happen in real time. Whereas if I was at some 9-to-5 office, they don't see what I'm doing. They don't know what that's like. They don't understand how getting the Wilson contract took 2 weeks and a few sleepless nights. Like they don't get that. But here they got it. They got to see it. When I had to cancel the show, they see how hard that is and how that can tear you up to have to let one of your babies go a little bit and do it for financial reasons. And then on the other hand, they get to see big successes like something get mentioned in a thing, or I had some artwork show up in the second, this is so dumb though, in the second National Treasure movie, the Nicolas Cage movies. Somebody, some fan worked on the show and did some digital stuff post-production, and there's a scene where Ed Harris is holding a newspaper and there's a drawing and a reference to my comic strip and my name down there on this paper. And that came out of nowhere. I had no idea that was going to happen. But you know how popular your kids think you are if that happens?
No, it's
totally dumb and no one's ever going to notice it. But your kids go, oh, dad, that's cool. It's just easier to raise your kids if they get to see you do this work all the time. So take that for whatever it's worth. But I'm a big believer in that having a kind of a radiating effect because I'm seeing them do it. I'm seeing them go out and take some of the dumb mistakes I've made and already know what to do instead of that. And it's pretty heartening.
That's pretty awesome. That's fantastic. 'Cause you're instilling in them confidence around their creativity. Maybe, or maybe not, you know, maybe they would, or maybe they would not have known or cared about kind of this creative direction had they not been as exposed to it, but they are. They're obviously very good at it, and they have an excellent mentor in the process. Not to mention a great dad. So
they also have it's also slower for them to rebel. They have less to rebel against because somebody else thinks I'm cool. They think I'm cool.
Right. Right.
And so you can get a lot of mileage on that and have them. You know, we do this Nerdtacular event for the last 10 years. Just did it a few weeks ago. And for them to come into a room where, you know, 800 plus people are wanting to shake your hand and have you sign their stuff. And they get this impression that you're kind of a cool dad. And so they have less incentive to be rebellious, I guess. I don't know. And that's been it's been the way for me. I can't say that's true for everybody. Like, I wouldn't want to be Will Smith's kid or... It's a bad example, but you know, like I think fame is the double-edged sword, but internet fame is kind of great because it's not really famous.
So we were just talking about Nerdtacular, and we're going to get to that in a second. I think one thing that's really important when you talk about Nerdtacular is, and we keep coming back to this, the sense of community that's built around all of the stuff that you're doing online. We talked a little bit about your art, but you do have a pretty monstrous podcast network going on, which you've added show after show after show over the years to, like The Morning Stream, which is your daily show, But I mean, you've got an insane amount of these shows, and I have to ask you how it's possible for you to keep up that. I mean, that's so much. Like, I imagine your daily schedule is just filled with podcasts, let alone making time for art. How do you do that?
Well, it's actually harder than I'd like it to be, because there's other things I'd like to be doing more of. I'd like to be streaming more video game content. I'd like to be doing more stuff on Twitch and YouTube. Like, there's a million things I need to do that I can't because I've filled my time so much.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I quit and did full time, it suddenly looked like I had all this extra time. And I probably overdid it a little bit. And I said, well, let's just fill every possible slot with something. I'll sleep when I'm dead sort of attitude. And that's, you know, I've had to back off that a little bit. You know, I do want to spend time with my family that isn't business related. You know, so you try to balance that stuff. But I don't know. It's just the shows I love doing, I just keep doing them. And the ones that I either lost passion for or for whatever reason just sort of dipped on the radar, I've learned to be okay with putting something to sleep or sticking on hiatus, reading the numbers, knowing what that means, understanding some people are going to be upset, but also knowing what's best for the network. I know Twitch had to do that, and it's hard. It's freaking hard to do that stuff. It's like firing people, kind of, except, you know, in my case, I'm just firing a show. But then there's a lot of other people on the outside who produce great content. We run it on the network, and, you know, I don't have to lift much of a finger there. And most of that stuff is just a lot of mutual beneficiary stuff going on, where you get to guest on my show, I get to guest on your show. We got bumpers running on each other's shows. Like a lot of really loose, easy sort of collaborative stuff happens that way. And then that audience grows, and there's a lot of crossover there. And, you know, we get chuckleheads from those Diamond Club people all the time, and they get our chuckleheads, and who knows what'll happen when that, when they get together. But yeah, like, you just have to figure out a way to find the balance. Right now, I'm in a really good place with that. I think all our temple shows are there and doing great. And some of them don't make me a dime, but I love them. And a couple of them make me a bunch of money. And that's good, because we need to survive. So I think the balance right now is about where I want it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, one show that we haven't even mentioned, I don't know if it's come up once, but it's actually pretty important to the history of you, is The Instance, which has been around for such a long time. Also kind of a testament to how strong of a community and a fan base World of Warcraft has. It's kind of insane that a show about World of Warcraft is still around and still, you know, is a popular thing in a, you know, at a time when World of Warcraft, I mean, how long has World of Warcraft been around? 15 years?
So it launched in 04, November of 04. I'd been playing the alpha since early 03. And it has been, I mean, I will say just straight up, one of the great things of my life and career has been covering Blizzard stuff, getting to know those people. Some of my favorite people and best friends now that I talk to around the internet and around the world either work for or have worked for Blizzard. It's been an incredible experience to do that. When I started The Instance, it was just because I couldn't find a show I liked about the game I was playing. That was it. Very quickly learned that there were a lot of people feeling that way. And before you knew it, the show was, you know, doing great and was ranked number one in video games for a very long time. And still goes to this day. It's the longest running show I have currently on the air. And we still love it, but you're right. That community stuff is built right in. These people want to find players who think like them, who want to play like them, who want to get together in real life and in game. Blizzard as a company is like that. So it's kind of the weird, perfect marriage that no one intended. And they have been nothing but wonderful and gracious to me over the years. And I love where that's been, where that has, where it's now, and where it may be going one day. It continues to be a real spotlight for me.
I feel like one recurring thing that's come up time and time again from this interview is this point that you're making around creating something because you like it and you realize there's nothing out there in the way that you would want it to be if you were on the other side. So you create it, which I think, you know, at its heart is very entrepreneurial of you. You realize that there's a lack of this thing. And, in, you know, this is what I would want if the tables were turned. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to create that. I think in the world of creativity and especially online content, that's a really big formula.
It's very much instinct, though, too. And I don't mean that I got the best instincts. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. But it's always a gut feeling that you go with that ends up being the right thing. It's very rarely when I'm doing a bunch of data analysis and trying to figure out projected numbers or turnover or attach rates. None of that stuff ever flies for me. It may come down the line after I've made a good choice, but my best choice is whether it's who do I ask to be a co-host, who's this new person I want to work with within the community, what new show am I launching, almost always from sort of the gut is where the best stuff has come. And I don't know how to control that very well, but I'm a big believer in it.
Yeah. Well, and the more you do it and the more you're proven that was the right choice, mm-hmm. the more you trust your gut. So you've built, this following around the podcast, around the art. Nerdtacular, as you mentioned right before the break, it's an event that you have been doing since 2007. And it's basically a coming together of all people who follow Frog Pants, right? You probably do a better job of explaining Nerdtacular at its core.
Well, it started back in 2007 as just me renting a movie theater. I had 150 seats available. And I thought, you know what? All the local listeners and fans, I'll just rent the theater and we'll all get together and we'll watch Spider-Man 3, which is not a good movie. It's a bad movie. But the idea was sound, you know, just to rent it. We'd throw some prizes out, chuck T-shirts into the audience and have stuff for kids there so people could bring their kids. And anyway, the whole thing filled up. We sold all of them. And then what's weird is a couple of people came from Kentucky. Somebody else was there from Paris, of all places. And I remember at the time going, what are you doing? You people are insane. It's just a Saturday for 2 hours. It was no big deal. And it was like fan appreciation. So that went well. And then we started talking, well, geez, that went well enough. Maybe we should do it again next year. So we did it again next year. This time it was Dark Knight. Good movie. All right. 2008. So we got lucky there. And that, by the way, we don't know until the movie happens if it was any good. So that was one of the risks of this thing. But that year we did 250 seats. The next year we did Star Trek and we did 335 seats. The year after that, 525 seats. We went all the way to 2010 in this format. And by 2010, we had other space reserved for after the film where we gave away stuff. We had food up there. Like, it started to look like a con. And it started to also be way more people from out of town and out of the country than there were in the Salt Lake area that were coming. So that's the year we decided next year we're going to go like little mini convention. We rented out a big convention space. We did a one-day event with panels and guests and people like Veronica Belmont and Tom Merritt and Brian Ibbett and all the people I work with, Terpster Patrick, all these people flooded here and we did this big thing for a day. And it was clear that that was going to be the way things went forward. So we did that 2 years in a row. Then we went up to this mountain resort called Snowbird, where people usually ski in the winter, but in the summer it's beautiful up there. And we do a 2-day event. That started in 2013 and we did that all the way up until 3 weeks ago. We're going to change some things moving forward. I don't know what this means yet, so I say this without knowing for sure. But this year we had 800 plus people, close to 900 people. That's as many as we could have for fire code because we had a ballroom that, you know, any more than that, we get in trouble. So the only two choices are either we get a new venue with way more seats or so we can sell more tickets, or we change things up. And I think we're going to change things up. I think we're going to start taking it on the road more. We're going to come to other conventions and do smaller Frog Pants meetups. We already do a big thing at BlizzCon every year for Blizzard's big event. So there'll be more of that, but also one-off events like board gaming events and who knows. Our goal was never to make a big convention and try to Comic-Con our way to the top. I don't want to run that business. What we always wanted out of this was a way to say thank you to the fans, give them a place to come meet each other, hang out, build friendships, build relationships. We have people who have gotten married because of their meeting at these things. Just a tight-knit kind of family event. It feels like a family reunion, and we intend to take that in new directions moving forward. But yeah, man, 10 years and it's been nuts, crazy 10 years.
I can't imagine how conflicted you might be at this point, knowing that, you know, the format is changing. So there's a little bit of unexpected reality coming soon. But then at the same time, like, it took a lot of you. I have to imagine it took a lot of your effort and your attention and, I don't know. I imagine that's no small feat setting something like that up year after year.
No, I'm still, honestly, it takes me about a month to recover from it. Yeah. And it takes most of the rest of the year to plan for it. And it's not like I'm doing that 24/7, but it's always in my head. I've always got stuff I have to do for it. It's expensive. There's a lot of risk involved. There's a lot of insurance involved. There's all the things you don't think about when running an event. But it's always been worth it. And everybody's been always just incredible and wonderful. And I mean, we had people from every continent there this year, and some people from as far away as Hong Kong and as close as two streets down the canyon. Like, it just is this big, crazy, I don't want to call it a love fest because it's starting to sound like a weird thing, but it's not. It's not like that, but it's just like this really great place where you can be yourself. You're in a safe place. People trust each other. There's just a lot of There's a lot of really good vibes there. And I'm going to miss this format, but I am excited about what we can maybe do in the future for what it means to bring communities together, go to places where they can't come this far, right, or have regional meetups where maybe I'm not even involved so much, but they can kind of bloom and blossom on their own and become their own thing. There's a lot of opportunity here, and we're just sort of, I don't know, we're in just finished one mode trying to figure out what's next mode, but we'll get there for sure.
Right on. Well, I highly regret the fact that I did not make it out to a Nerdtacular. That's no.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll bring the next one to you. Who knows? I'll be out and we'll bring it to Petaluma next time. I don't know.
We have an extra room in our home. We have a den. I think we can fit everyone there.
You got room for about 1,200 people. It'll be fine.
I think we can make that work. Okay. So final question. This has just been, by the way, so awesome talking with you. I love every chance I get to chat with you, and especially to chat about passion. I'm way big into the whole kind of passion around creative arts and stuff. So it's super inspiring to me to hear you talk about kind of where you've been able to bring your passion and make it, you know, a success in all parts of your life. What would you say at this point is your, like, your biggest dream? If you have a dream, if things continue the way they are and you're building towards something, I don't know if that's a 10-year or a 20-year plan, but looking forward, what do you hope to accomplish?
That's a really good question. I think probably, wow, that's actually a really great question. Because so much of it is hacking through the jungle with a machete, trying to figure out where you're going as you're doing it. And there's so much about what we and what Twit and what everybody's doing that is unknown. Like, we're just still kind of scraping what's possible from our independent position. What I hope to do in the next 10 years is adhere to the changes that happen, follow the technological curve, so that I don't want to ever be behind in this. Like, I don't ever want to be in a place where I don't understand what the kids are doing. And that sounds like an old man thing. And I don't mean it to sound that way. But what I mean is, I don't want to be that person that really got into ham radio, but that's where it stopped for them. I want to be willing to move forward. If VR is the future of the way we create independent entertainment or whatever it may be, commentary, then I want to be there for it. If it's something else, if it's AR, if it's haptic suits across the world, whatever it is, I would like to make sure I'm still there. I don't want to say, well, if it's not an RSS feed and an MP3 and a couple of ID3 tags, I'm out. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something I just want to make sure I'm always open to. You always see people, even in technology, that get to a certain place. They're like, all right, I'm good. And they don't want to learn new things. They don't want to see new stuff. They don't want to, you know, follow the trend. And I'm very interested in not being that person. So that's maybe number one. Number two, and more specifically to what I'm doing, I just hope in 10 years, 20 years, maybe even 30 years, this guy get too crazy. I hope that I'm still doing this. Like, I want to still be doing this, and I want to be doing it for people that still are interested in what my take is. I want to still be podcasting. I want to still be drawing. And when I can't draw anymore, my hands are too shaky or whatever, when I'm 85 years old, okay, fine, I'll put that to the side. But the idea of retiring this sounds crazy to me. As much as it'd be nice to say, well, I hope one day to sell the whole thing for a few million dollars and move on. Maybe, but that's not really what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. I want to make stuff. So my goal is to keep making it as long as I can. And so, again, I'll sleep when I'm dead sort of thing, I figure. Those are really loose goals, I realize, right? Like, nothing I just gave you is very concrete, but
doesn't have to
kinda
be.
It's kind of how it's worked for me. And if anything, this fluidity is what is almost required. You have to be able to adhere to what happens. This changes so fast. We're now looking at, you know, what are we, 15, I don't know, 12, 13 years past official podcasting as a thing, RSS feeds, that sort of stuff. Like, that's a pretty good chunk of time. To all of us, it still seems very new and very quick, and that's the nature of this stuff. So, like technology itself, it's just this rapid rise, and you have to stay with it and be willing to veer off when it makes the sense to veer off. And that's all I'm saying, I guess, is I want to be agile like that and not lock myself into what I think is good and then end up being the equivalent of a ham radio operator in 2020.
Right. And I like to think that when you're 80 and your hands don't or might not work anymore and you can't draw in the way that you're used to, you'll be using your mind.
Yeah, see?
That'll probably happen. That'll probably happen in our lifetime.
It probably will. Like, I'm We have been, I would say you're in the same category, you're a little younger than I am, but we are in this generation that has been lucky enough to have really cool advancements happen right when we needed them to.
Yeah.
And I feel a little, you know, I feel a little guilty about that because, like, straight up, you could even look at, like, things like the VCR and DVD, and when they happened were perfect times for me. CDs were perfect timing. Cassette tapes were perfect for when I was a kid. Like, they just were the right time for the right thing, and we're entering this era of an embarrassment of riches when it comes to technology and entertainment, how we get it, where we get it, how cheaply we get it. Like, it's an amazing time to be alive. So I don't see any reason why that has to stop. Just keep going till I'm 85 or however long I got. And, you know, I got a long ways to go, people. That's like twice my life. I don't want to freak anybody out here or anything. but think about these things. My kids are growing up. One of them's, you know, or two of them are, one of them's completely out of the house. The other one's about to be. And the next one's about to graduate high school. No one's getting any younger. I just don't want to be that old guy that's like, I don't understand you kids with your holographic unit and your whatnot. I want to be grandpa who knows it, you know?
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I have a feeling as the years progress, frogpants.com is still going to continue to be kind of your hub online for all of the projects that you're doing. You say their podcast, art, streaming, all sorts of stuff. You can find all of Scott's work both in the podcast realm and in the art. You've also got a store there that sells a lot of your prints and shirts, all sorts of stuff. That's the beauty of being a digital artist is you can put that stuff on anything.
Yeah, no kidding. It's actually one of the other benefits is both the comic side and the podcast side. Everybody wants swag, it seems like, so we try to provide it.
Right on. And then also, of course, your webcomic, myextralife.com. You're updating that. Is that a daily thing or is...
No, it's roughly weekly now, although these family reunions messed me up last week, so I'm a little bit behind, but I got a fresh one going up either today or tomorrow. But yeah, there's a huge 14, whatever year it is, archive there, and it's all free. So if somebody wants to go check out all that stuff, they can. And if they really like it, like I said, there are a couple of copies of the compilation book still on the store in hardback and softback. So if somebody's still just dying to get that, see, he's got one right there.
Yep, I got one.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome stuff.
Thank you for that support, by the way. That means a lot.
Absolutely, man. It was my pleasure.
It's a lot of fun. I put a lot of weird stuff in that thing, put a lot of passion into it. I hope people enjoy it. And the cover art is not, I didn't do the cover art. It was created by a good friend of mine, Howard Porter, who is a DC Comics artist. And he did an incredible job. And you don't know it, but there are like three or four podcast references in that image. And it doesn't even matter because it's just this cool dude that killed all these superheroes. So anyway, if you want your own, it's available there. And I really appreciate you having me on today. It's been it's a blast. Always fun to go on Twitch shows, but always good to talk to you, Jason.
Right on. You too, Scott. Where can people follow you online? I'm sure you've got the socials going on. In fact, I know you do. I follow you.
Yeah, of course. In fact, remember when you and I were talking about changing our Twitter accounts to our real names? Remember that whole thing back in the day?
Oh, I remember. I remember, yeah.
I'm glad we did that.
I am too. In retrospect, I'm very glad. But there have been some rocky moments. It's still a point of confusion for a lot of people, by the way. But I'm happy
it it can be a weird thing. Yeah. But if you want to, of course, frogpants.com's got all this stuff. But if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Scott Johnson, just as it sounds spelled out. I think you'll like what I have to say over there if you haven't already checked it out. And outside of that, you can probably, you know what? Actually, you know what? If you want to see shows when they're streamed live, here's a good place to go. Go to Frog Pants TV. Takes you straight to our Twitch page. Got a nice burgeoning community happening over there. Every show that we do, or most of them anyway, are recorded live there and then put out on the podcast feed. So it's a great place to get into the live chat room and hang out. But that and all that other stuff can be found at frogpants.com.
Right on. Scott Johnson, keep up the awesome work. And thank you for hopping on today. This was a lot of fun. Appreciate
Thanks, man. It. Right, thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. You, by the way, can watch all of our interviews here on Triangulation. We talk to a lot of cool people, as you just saw. And if you go to twit.tv/TRI, or you go to twit.tv/triangulation, you can find all the information that you need to subscribe to the show, to find the back catalog, which has well over 300 interviews at this point. We've got a lot in there, probably some that you've missed, so you might as well go diving and see what you come out with. And if you want to catch it live, we record live every Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, 1800 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can watch all our live shows there as they're recorded. But that is it for today's episode of Triangulation. I'm Jason Howell. Thanks so much for inviting me into your ears along with Scott Johnson today. And we'll see you next time on Triangulation.